Thank you very much for that warm welcome. Portland has a very special quality that I feel very at home here when I come. It's your gracious and thoughtful city. Well, I want to build on what we did here last time. We were looking at the state of our worldview, how it affects the state of our world, how it led to it in many ways. Worldviews create worlds, how we view reality, the assumptions and presuppositions, operating principles by which we approach the world, that shapes the world. It responds to our assumptions. And we talked about the extent to which the modern worldview had created a situation of great peril. In a certain way, we could say modernity, when we last left it here in our discussion, it was in very perilous condition, like on the in a melodrama, it's on the train tracks, as it were, except modernity is the train as well as the victim that's on the train tracks. It's the victim of its own unconscious juggernaut in a certain way. It takes a fair amount of spiritual fortitude in our time to absorb the full condition of the world, the grievous condition, the extinction of species that is happening. Is perhaps the most emotionally and existentially challenging of all. But there are so many aspects to this threshold that we seem to be approaching with greater and greater intensity and acceleration, and to maintain equilibrium while keeping our eyes wide open and our discernment alert. It takes a great spiritual and moral strength. Hope and hopelessness are, to a certain extent, the underlying theme of our moment right now. And I'm not so much talking about optimism. Many will say that the data do not support an optimistic conclusion, but hope and optimism are different things. Hope is a theological virtue. It has something to do with an openness to something larger going on than we necessarily can comprehend with our limited reason. A trust in something, perhaps some larger mystery unfolding. So in such a state as our world is in today, particularly perhaps these last 7 years have been especially challenging, it's easy to fall into a kind of apocalypse complex. And the distinguished New York Jewish philosopher Woody Allen put his finger on the situation with great precision and with his customary Schopenhauerian clarity. This is Woody Allen. More than at any other time in history, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness. The other, to total extinction. Let us pray we have the wisdom to choose correctly. I speak, by the way, not with any sense of futility, but with a panicky conviction of the absolute meaninglessness of existence, which could easily be misinterpreted as pessimism. It is not. It is merely a healthy concern for the predicament of modern man. Modern man is here defined as any person born after Nietzsche's edict that God is dead, but before the hit recording, I want to hold your hand. So. He's actually managed to put it all together there. I mean, he basically, in some sense, grasps the connections between, on the one hand, the modern ecological crisis, extinction of species that's happening at a tremendously rapid rate today, sixth major extinction, but human-caused. And he's connected extinction with the existential, psychological, spiritual crisis. He recognizes that they're connected in a certain way. Behind it, or underlying it, he brings in the disenchantment of the cosmos, the destruction of the metaphysical world, the death of God. And then he also has framed it in that particular way that reflects the masculine, heroic, tragic drama man, mankind, man, man faces a crossroads and so forth. That particular masculine inflection that gives to the human condition a particular flavor that has a lot to do with the way the psychological, philosophical, religious, and scientific evolution of the West has unfolded, and that has played a large role in the constellating of the contemporary condition. Let's try to unpack what that state is. There's many, many different concrete problems that we are so familiar with that every headline in every paper and magazine and State of the World report lists like a litany of the concrete problems, social, political, economic, ecological. But if we are to try to see what was informing, what was underlying, what was encompassing all these specific concrete problems, I think we could pinpoint three. One is that sense that today we are in some sense lacking in any overarching context of meaning, what depth psychologists call a container, something that gives our lives coherence, deeper significance. There's just a profound metaphysical disorientation, a groundlessness that pervades contemporary human experience. Just a widely felt absence of any adequate, publicly accessible, larger order of purpose and significance. A kind of guiding meta-narrative that transcends separate cultures and subcultures, and that in its very nature, it gives to collective human existence a nourishing coherence and intelligibility. That's missing. Second is that deep sense of alienation or separation that shapes the experience of the modern self, the modern individual in mass society, what David Reisman called the lonely crowd, but also that subjective sense of human separation that Homo sapiens as a species experiences between it and the rest of nature and the cosmos, and that spiritual estrangement of the modern psyche in a disenchanted universe. So that's all connected to this underlying sense of estrangement or alienation. And then the third condition is a deep sense of a need for insight into those powerful unconscious forces that are both creative and destructive that shape human lives, both individual and collective. So in sum, we've got a loss of meaning, a sense of isolation, and a sense of unconsciousness that is especially problematic when you have a very powerful technologically enhanced civilization that is being driven by unconscious archetypal factors. So these three conditions, they surround and permeate our contemporary consciousness just like the atmosphere in which we breathe. And they're the result of a tremendous amount of historical development and evolution that is interconnected with the most positive, admirable, liberating qualities of that history. This is the great paradox of modernity and of the West, and even of the human condition generally, which is that the light and the shadow are so inextricably intertwined. There's this tremendously heroic, dynamic, let's talk about in particular the West, intertwined with a great shadow that has caused tremendous suffering, destruction of other cultures, other forms of life, and now threatens the planet, the Earth community in a very global way. Cosmology is the container for everything else, and that's why I am addressing our attention tonight to cosmology, because everything that happens inside the cosmology, everything that a society acts upon, all the ways in which we construe the world, all that is happening within a cosmos, a cosmos that is shaped by a cosmology, how we view it. And when you live in a disenchanted universe, then literally nothing is sacred. And everything can be appropriated. Everything can be exploited for advertising, for marketing, for creating products, for consumerism. And children's minds are marketing targets, and indigenous tribes are in the way of progress, and old growth forests are just lumber. Animals are harvestable commodities. Everything can be appropriated. And when you, in addition, have the situation of a spiritual hunger that is not being fed by this meaningless cosmos that contains no capacity for purposes and meanings other than what human beings subjectively project onto the world, in that condition, the spiritual hunger on the mass level tries to fill itself by consumerism. A kind of techno-consumerist frenzy is driving the life of the planet in a way that is cannibalizing it. So it's not just a theoretical or a psychological problem. It's a very pragmatic problem. So it was this complex historical drama that I basically sought to understand, how Western development had taken place, the emergence of the modern mind, modern self, and bringing us up to this point. This is what I sought to do with my first book, The Passion of the Western Mind. But I was mainly doing that because I wanted to have that serve as the introduction for a second work, Cosmos and Psyche. In fact, Passion of the Western Mind was supposed to be just the first two or three chapters of Cosmos and Psyche, but those of you who are writers know that books have a mind of their own. You pretty much have to go with what the muses are telling you, where they lead. And, but Jung was the pioneer in this area, and it was through him that I first gained a sense that this would be a path that could give a new perspective on those three conditions I talked about, that sense of alienation, metaphysical estrangement and disorientation, and that lack of consciousness into what are the major archetypal unconscious forces that are at work in the collective psyche at any given time and in our individual lives. The possibility that astrology could have any relevance to this was so far off my radar screen, as I believe it would be for anybody who got a good 20th century education. Astrology is the gold standard of superstition in our culture. If you want to say something is really, like, you know, just absolute rubbish, then you would say, well, this would be like astrology. I mean, you can't go any more ridiculous than that. And one can see why, if your basic sense of astrology is coming from the sun sign horoscope columns in the newspaper and an image of, you know, fortune-telling predictions. And if you basically have a sense that the universe is something that has evolved randomly in such a way that out of this fundamentally material substrate, this material cosmos that has no capacity for carrying or signifying anything, somehow human consciousness emerged as an isolated oddity and brings into the universe an awareness that was not there before, and that in some sense the human being is absolutely superior to the rest of the universe out of which it emerged, that we are capable of spiritual aspirations, moral and aesthetic values, conscious intelligence, but the universe out of which we emerge has none of these qualities. This is what we all grow up with, this basic contradiction, to think of it in terms of Romanticism and the Enlightenment, you know, the two big cultural legacies that inform modernity. The Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution has the loyalty of the modern mind, and Romanticism, from Rousseau and Goethe and Emerson right up through the 60s psychedelic counterculture, Romanticism has the allegiance of the modern soul. You know, our music, our poetry, our deep aspirations for something beyond the reductionist view of modern science. So we've all grown up with this contradiction. And Jung, basically, and the whole depth psychology tradition is sort of holding that tension of opposites. It's holding that tension between the soul and the mind, or between the depth of interior aspirations and the disenchanted universe of the modern scientific perspective. And he struggled with this all through his life. And many of the confusing and contradictory statements that are in Jung's writings from beginning to end reflect this struggle, this really heroic struggle to hold that tension and try to figure out, because he kept having experiences that contradicted the disenchanted cosmology, but at the same time, that cosmology, that worldview was so firmly established that he didn't know how to bring into coherence these powerful epiphanies that he himself was having and also his patients. And it was really only in the last 15 years that he started to kind of break free from the old paradigm, and particularly through his study of synchronicities and his recognition that these powerful inner archetypal principles that were numinous and that gave human life meaning and that informed our dreams and our religious experiences and our artistic works, that these somehow were expressing themselves also in the material world outside of the human being in such a way that suggested there was a kind of intelligent coherence between inner and outer that pointed to the possibility that the archetypes informed matter as well as spirit, object as well as subject, and that the world was therefore constituted in a different way than we had been educated to believe. Now, there are many Jungs. He was a very complex figure. We can think of Jung the physician, the healer, very practical, just wanting to know whatever works, just very pragmatic. Then there's Jung the scientist, the empiricist of the psyche, of the unconscious. There's Jung the philosopher. There's Jung the man of religion, the spiritual seeker, the Gnostic, the mystic, the prophet. There's Jung the writer, Jung the teacher, the lecturer, Jung the pastor, the preacher of sermons. There's Jung the parapsychologist. He was always interested, as James Hillman emphasized, in the odd phenomenon, the coincidence, the anomaly, the heresy. And then there's Jung the esotericist, interested in alchemy and hermeticism and the I Ching and divination and astrology. And that brings us to tonight's topic. We know that Jung was interested in astrology from as early as 1911, because that's when he wrote that letter to Freud where he said, "I'm so focused on astrology in the evenings now. It's my main preoccupation. Many remarkable things are turning up." And as the decades passed and he kept working with it, struggling to understand it, at times he would describe it as the summation of ancient and medieval psychology. It's all packed into the astrological tradition. But he saw that as somehow being projected out onto the heavens from the collective unconscious. But then also, he was noticing how well it worked so helpfully that by the end of his life, in the last 15-20 years, he was using astrological charts and transits with all of his patients. So I first heard about this when I was an undergraduate at Harvard. There was a Harvard Divinity School professor who had been trained by Jung. One time he came in and started telling me where my different planets' positions were. And I just thought he had taken leave of his senses. I mean, here I was accustomed to talking with him about Freud and Jung and European culture and the history of ideas, and suddenly we're talking about this, you know, ludicrous superstition. And so I steered the conversation as quickly as I could back to more accustomed topics. And that was as if the astrological goddess had knocked on my door and I did not open it. And I had no encounter with astrology for several years after that. And then I came to Esalen Institute. I studied with Joseph Campbell and Houston Smith and Gregory Bateson, but I especially was interested in studying with Stanislav Grof. And I lived there for 10 years and became the director of programs after a few years. But while we were there, Stan Grof and myself in particular, we were particularly trying to understand what it was about, you know, he was the kind of master therapist of using psychedelic therapy, LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, MDA. And we were trying to understand a particular problem, which those of you who have done, had sacred medicine journeys or shamanic experiences in ritual like ayahuasca, and those of you who have done this kind of work or, you know, had LSD journeys in your early, in your youth, or last night, as the case may be, will be aware of a very powerful riddle, which is, why is it that the exact same substance with the exact same dosage could be taken by two different people and have such radically different experiences, or the same person at different times? And one of the experiences could be extremely spiritually ecstatic and transformative in the most benign, positive way, and another one could be nightmarish beyond one's worst fears. And so the psychiatrists who had been working for many years with these substances back in Prague and in Maryland at the National NIMH-sponsored research that they were doing there, had used all the conventional scientific psychological tests like MMPI, the Rorschach, the thematic apperception test. None of them had any predictive value for understanding why different people at different times, or the same person at different times, would have such different experiences. But so much was at stake, so there's a lot of interest in this. Back then in the 60s and 70s, many therapists in a variety of schools, whether it was psychoanalysts or Jungians or Gestalt or Reichian bioenergetic therapists, felt that the future lay in having psychedelic adjunct to their form of therapy because it so catalyzed the unconscious and had such powerful acceleration of the psychological transformation and potential healing with a powerful spiritual dimension. So there was a lot of focus on this particular problem. Now, Esalen at this point was a kind of what I imagine the inside of Jung's mind was like in the 1950s was something like the morphic field of the Esalen community and the teachers and you know, faculty members, but also the staff and community that lived there all the time. And so things like, you know, the I Ching or talking about karma, reincarnation, the synchronicities, the Tao, and astrological charts were just all part of the conversation. They were just part of the dialogue. It was a kind of enchanted cosmos that I entered into when I came into that community. And I was especially struck by the fact that many people who I regarded as otherwise intelligent took astrology seriously. So, at one point, an astrologer came through who showed Stan Grof and myself how to calculate birth charts and how to calculate, and this was especially important, how to calculate transits, which is where the planets are at any given time in the sky relative to where they were at a person's birth. Like, you know, Jupiter's in a certain position in the sky right now, and it could be in conjunction to a person's sun or moon at the time of their birth. And that particular transit in the astrological perspective would coincide with experiences that reflected the archetypal qualities associated with those particular planets. Well, I'd seen enough and trusted the people who were pointing in this direction enough, plus I had Jung's example behind me, that we decided to do some initial research along this line. We had very good records of all our own personal sessions, for example. We were both blown away by the precision of the correlation between what kinds of experiences we had on a particular date and the particular transits that we had. It was so striking and it was so consistent that I started examining the transits for all the people there at Esalen, and they used to just kind of line up at the gate shack where I was in my first years there. I was a gate guard, probably the best job I ever had, particularly being a night guard, which is when I got to see the heavens, the night sky in Big Sur. So the research just kept expanding from, you know, the individuals in my personal acquaintance to then, you know, everybody that was coming through Esalen. Then I started studying, well, what was happening in the charts and the lives of people who were well-known figures who I'd spent my life studying, like what did Jung have as a transit when he went through all those experiences in the 19-teens that became the basis for his life work? What transit did Galileo have when he first turned the telescope to the heavens? What transits did Betty Friedan have when she wrote The Feminine Mystique and catalyzed the women's movement? What transits did Rosa Parks have when she refused to get up from the bus and started the civil rights movement? And to see how the exact same transits that coincided with psychological breakthroughs also could come through in the lives of public figures at the time that they made significant creative breakthroughs, and that also there were transits that tended to coincide with more, you know, problematic periods, crises, falling in love, falling out of love, the periods of great intensified maturation, and so forth. I then started seeing how also entire epochs seemed to coincide with major outer planet alignments that were going on for the whole world, as it were, for a sustained amount of time. For example, the 1960s, with its very characteristic archetypal quality of revolutionary turmoil and tremendous urge to make the world new and to liberate oneself and one's society from constraints and traditions and the status quo, to see that the same planets were in conjunction there for that entire decade, that were operative in individual lives and personal transits for when individuals were going through periods of great radical transformation and or creative breakthroughs and so forth. And that collectively, that the same thing that was happening in the 60s, a big alignment of those two planets has to be Pluto and Uranus, were also in alignment during the French Revolution. It's about a 12-13 year transit, 1960 to 72, 1787 to 1798, exact period, French Revolution, when right across the world, from Mutiny on the Bounty in the South Pacific to France and Germany and England and, or in the Caribbean and Haiti, there were revolutions happening all around the world and tremendous push to change things and liberate and overthrow the oppressive establishment and so forth. And then to just see how other transits would be coinciding with the periods of great spiritual change and religious awakenings, and other transits coincided with periods of great historical crisis and contractions and empowerment of conservative or reactionary forces, such as in 2001, the same alignment was going on then as was going on right at the beginning of both World War I and World War II. So by the later 1970s, I pretty much had glimpsed the extent of the way in which the planetary alignments seem to be so consistently coincident with the archetypal patterns of human experience that it suggested that where Jung was going in his later life was valid on a level that even, I mean, he said at times that he felt astrology could be an example of synchronicity on the grand scale. And he certainly worked with it a lot, but he didn't have all sorts of things that we have available to us now. The research wasn't there, the computers, the detailed understanding we have of where the planets were all through history. But he clearly was moving towards what I now believe is the reality of these archetypal forces, which is that they reflect not just an intrapsychic human collective unconscious, but rather the collective unconscious seems to be in some way continuous with and embedded in the cosmos itself, the world soul, the anima mundi. And as Robert Aziz has brilliantly shown in his work, in the course of Jung's life, as he started to take in the significance of synchronicities, he started understanding that the sacred circle within which human psychological, spiritual unfolding, the individuation process takes place, that sacred circle is no longer the intrapsychic interior world alone. It is all of nature and the entire cosmos that is in some sense that sacred circle within which the individuation is taking place. In fact, not just the individuation of the individual, but in some sense of the collective. That humanity itself seems to be going through some profound transformative threshold right now. And it seems as if the increasing understanding and awareness of the cosmos as itself a carrier of meanings and purposes that transcend the human being, and yet the human being participates in them. This awareness coming in as it is in our time, such a crucial time in Earth's evolution, may not be an accident. It may also be a synchronicity in Jung's sense. There's a sentence from the philosopher of science, Percy Bridgman, where he said, "Coincidences are what you have left over after you've applied a bad theory." And people who have seen, you know, many synchronicities in their lives recognize that if you keep assuming a totally random, purposeless universe, then these are all just coincidences. But if you've got many, many coincidences that you are alert to, then this could suggest that maybe we need to reframe our worldview so that it can accommodate the fact that these may not be just coincidences. They may be, in some sense, meaningful. They may, in some sense, be pointing towards a larger context of spiritual purposes and psychologically relevant meanings that the human being is a participant, a co-creative agent within, and not simply projecting from our isolated brain corner onto the world. Now, this is very challenging. The astrological synchronicities shouldn't be happening if we live in the universe that we assume we are living in, if we take physics 101 as being the bottom line. How could this possibly work? I am convinced that causality in the sense of mechanistic linear causality, the billiard ball hitting the other billiard ball and causing it to move, is probably not what is at work. I doubt that the planets are making things happen in a literal mechanistic way. Rather, they, I believe, are in some sense indicative of the archetypal dynamics of the anima mundi. They, in the same way that like my watch says it's 8:35, that is not causing it to be 8:35. The clock on the wall doesn't cause the time to be that time. It is reflecting it. It's indicating it. And that seems to me more likely that the universe is so constituted in such an integral way, it is so fundamentally united at all dimensions of its being, above and below, as the ancient esoteric dictum put it, inner and outer, celestial and terrestrial. In all these ways, it is so coherently integrated that the movements of the planets and the sun and the moon are in some sense connected to, associated with these powerful archetypal principles and their moving alignments. Plotinus, the great Neoplatonic philosopher during the period of the Roman Empire, he put it beautifully. He said, "The stars are like letters which inscribe themselves at every moment in the sky. Everything in the world is full of signs. All events are coordinated. All things depend on each other. As has been said, everything breathes together. Everything breathes together." I think he's put his finger on probably one of the best ways of understanding it. Then the question comes up about free will and determinism. If these powerful archetypal dynamics and complexes are happening and getting constellated in the collective psyche as they do, in such, in a sense, predictable way that we can know when these alignments of the planets will be happening, then what does that say about human free will? I think here the breakthrough for me came first partly just through observation and also through the understanding of the archetypes, because archetypes are not literal entities that have a single meaning that then, because Mars is here on a person's sun, they're getting angry or becoming more vigorous or ardent, or it's not a simple Mars equals macho anger or Venus equals a desire to be beautiful or ornamenting oneself or something like that. Each of these archetypal principles are fundamentally multivalent. They each have such a range of potential meanings, so that, for example, Saturn, it represents, you know, contraction and limit and structure of things, but it's also that focuses and concentrates and disciplines, and it also relates to maturation, time, chronos, age, experience, the wisdom that comes from experience, suffering that comes from experience and age and time and old age, the Senex principle, Senex, Latin, senescence, senility, senator. It's true though. I mean, that's the root, Senex. Hillman's brilliant on the Senex, and the Saturn principle is the Senex in Jungian psychology, and Hillman brilliantly unpacks that. And they just are coming out with a new book that contains his classic essays on Puer, the child, the eternal child archetype, and the Senex. And so Saturn also relates to the endings of things and death, gravity, gravitas, heaviness, gravity in the Newtonian physical sense, but gravity in the sense of seriousness and weightiness, and gravity in the sense of moral sobriety. All those are Saturn. Saturn is, you know, dark and it's cold and it rules lead and the heavy elements of life. That archetypal multivalence, and one can do the same thing with Venus and Mars and Jupiter and so forth. Each of these archetypal principles connected to it seems as if the ancients accurately named the planets. Rudolf Steiner talks about them having a kind of primal clairvoyant capacity, like a kind of intuitive spiritual vision, that as the capacity for rational thought developed, the clairvoyant intuitive capacity diminished, that the gain of one was the eclipse of the other, with the period of the Greek awakening being the crucial turning point, and then modernity being the kind of completion of that trajectory. So it seems to be in the very existence of the archetype's multivalent range of ways in which these gods and goddesses can express themselves, that human free will gets its purchase, that it is to a crucial extent up to us as to how a given archetype can come through, whether we act it out in a destructive way or whether we bring out its more life-enhancing form. Charlie Chaplin and Adolf Hitler, for example, their charts are almost identical. They're born just 4 days apart. Most of the planets are still in the same alignments with each other, and yet and they have many similarities in their personal character and lives. They both, you know, struggled with very hard conditions, parents, problematic parenting. Both had dictatorial tendencies. Both of them had artistic impulses. Both were brilliant communicators. Both were both put on vast illusions that affected millions of people. But what radically different moral vectors that these two individuals had in themselves, that by which they enacted or actualized the archetypal potentials in their birth charts. So I now believe, and while there's certainly, there is a deterministic potential in, particularly in ancient medieval astrology, it was more pronounced, but in some sense, I think astrology needed to be eclipsed. We needed to break out of the sense of an astrological determinism for the modern self to get its sense of autonomy that would in many ways make, you know, democracy and critical intelligence emerge in a way that now gives us a capacity to go back and reconnect to the anima mundi in a new way. Because our task today is not simply to rediscover the anima mundi, it's to forge a new relationship to it by which our own capacity for conscious autonomy comes into a participatory engagement with these powerful archetypal principles, these gods and goddesses of the psyche, of the cosmos, that in some sense come through us, use us as their vessels, but also in some sense, I suspect the cosmos has been forging a partner, a conscious partner, through which it can come to a new consciousness of itself. Jung said, the stars have fallen from heaven, and so we have psychology. He was talking about how the ancients lived in a universe in which the gods existed, and were connected to the heavens, and when the universe was disenchanted, that container, that numinous encompassing container, collapsed, and that in some sense forced the human soul in on itself, and psychology emerged out of that. In some sense, the late 19th century was the crisis point where a kind of psychopathology emerged for the Cartesian ego. It had gotten to a point where, as Jung said, the gods had become our diseases. If you basically take the whole anima mundi and say it doesn't exist, all this conscious intelligence, soul and spirit in the whole universe that was seen to pervade the whole universe in all other pre-modern, non-Western cultures. If you now say that only the human being has that capacity, so it's like being this vacuum cleaner has just taking the whole soul of the world, of the whole cosmos, and just put it into the human self. And then you basically make that into the human unconscious and suppress it. And it's only coming out in dreams and in religious eruptions and in artistic works. No wonder the late 19th century started bringing forth all these people whose neuroses and psychoses basically catalyzed the birth of depth psychology. And it was many women in particular who worked with Freud and Jung to bring about depth psychology. I mean, a lot of brilliant, creative, highly sensitive, and disturbed women coming as patients to Freud and Jung, who in a kind of, it was a kind of participatory, I mean, each was giving something to the other in a very helpful way in the end, very fruitful way. But I now believe that we have a new and ancient tool by which the Depth Psychology Project can be forwarded, because this archetypal astrology that is emerging gives us the capacity to understand what archetypes are being constellated in what combinations and at what times, in such a way that it can give both individuals and whole societies a new capacity for conscious reflection upon and critical insight into those archetypal dominants, and thereby be able to work with them. And it not only provides that kind of psychological insight by which we are not so much puppets of the unconscious, but instead are conscious participants, it not only does that, it heals a certain schism, a certain sense of isolation, of cosmic estrangement that has been so characteristic of the modern condition. You know, it was Pascal who first saw this in the 17th century when he said, "I am terrified by the eternal silence of these infinite spaces," looking out at the modern universe that was emerging from the scientific revolution. And, you know, one thinker after another started taking in those implications. Calvin and Hobbes, there's a great cartoon, another great philosopher of our time, Bill Waters. Calvin is looking up at the night sky in the first image, and he's not saying anything, he's just looking up. Then in the second image, with huge letters, he screams, "I'm significant." And then in the third image, nothing is said. He doesn't say anything. The starry sky isn't saying anything. And then in the fourth image, in very tiny letters, it says, "Scream the dust speck." And that Calvin himself is reflecting on the modern condition. Scream the dust speck. This is the earth as just a dust speck going around an insignificant star, one amongst billions, that is itself in a galaxy that is just one galaxy amongst billions, and so forth. We're just this meaning-seeking speck of dust in a vast, meaningless cosmos. And that's the modern condition that we grew up with. And what's that famous quote from Steven Weinberg, the leading cosmologist, in his summary of modern cosmology? He said, "It's almost irresistible for humans to believe that we have some special relation to the universe, to believe that human life is not just a more or less farcical outcome of a chain of accidents. It's very hard to realize that this is all just a tiny part, our Earth here, of an overwhelmingly hostile universe. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless." Okay, that's his famous summary of modern cosmology, the first 3 minutes. It's a cosmology that is almost designed to create depression. And Woody Allen is like the, you know, kind of like a paradigm example of it there. And what the astrological evidence points to is the possibility of basically healing that. Like, it not only provides us this extraordinarily helpful insight as psychologists. I mean, you know, I've heard it once, I've heard it 100 times, a person say that one astrology reading was more helpful than 6 months of analysis. It allows one to go, if it's a good reading with, you know, a gifted astrologer, it can go right to the heart of what are the major archetypal dynamics of you at this time, as well as what is your lifelong, tendencies and so forth. But it also, beyond that kind of very pragmatic aid, it also gives us a kind of healing of the larger modern existential crisis. And in that sense, it has a kind of spiritual luminosity to it that's quite encompassing, quite global. If we think of Jung's insight that synchronicities often tend to come at a time when it is serving to compensate for the one-sided conscious attitude. It's like a message from the whole, from the unconscious, to compensate the one-sided narrow conscious attitude. And the golden scarab comes in the window of the woman who is the patient, who's very resistant to any deeper meanings, and she's telling the dream to Jung of a golden scarab that was given to her the night before in the dream. And right at that moment, there's this insistent tapping at the window, and Jung finally opens up the window, and there's a golden scarab insect. The rose chafer looks just like a golden scarab, and he picks it up and he gives it to her and says, "And here's your golden scarab." And it has this awakening effect on her. It just breaks her open to the fact that there's more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in her philosophy. And it is not impossible that golden scarab coming in the window is, in some sense, that's what's happening with the astrological synchronicities, this vast range of evidence and, very precisely, elegantly patterned correlations between planetary alignments and the archetypal patterns of human experience coming in as it is now is perhaps a kind of our golden scarab for the modern mind, which has been so disenchanting in its perception, and now is in a position to be able to open up to a new universe. Hillman has that book called "We've Had 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World's Getting Worse," and the psychotherapy that he's talking about is a psychotherapy that is constrained by a soulless universe. I mean, it's very hard to heal the soul of a person who then walks out of the consulting room into a soulless universe. But if we enter into an ensouled world and an ensouled cosmos, the whole psychological path becomes transformed as well. So there's many levels at which this evidence may be helpful for us in our time. And I'll just end with something that I started a year and a half ago when I was here by quoting Nietzsche, that beautiful sentence that he has in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, where he said, "The world is deep, deeper than day can comprehend." The world is deep, deeper than day can comprehend. Because the world is both day and night. And the day is, of course, the solar, ruled by the sun. Sun, which is the light of consciousness, it's also the solar monotheistic ego, the hero archetype. Ours has been the most solar dominated civilization in all history, from "Let there be light" in Genesis and the Platonic sun as the divine reason and good shining its light of intelligibility on the whole universe, to the Enlightenment and the modern mind and its identification with the solar principle of brilliant illumination, it's transcending the world. But it's a single light that, when it shines, all other lights are blocked out. The night sky is ruled by the moon, and the moon, when it shines, has many other lights that can be shining at the same time. All the gods and goddesses, in a sense, are still visible with the moon. And the moon itself has a more fluid relationship to light and darkness in itself, as well as in its what it permits to be seen. The night is the mystery of the whole. Out of every night sky is born the day. And the sun comes at dawn, conquers the darkness, and as the hero does, goes on its trajectory and its journey, and it rises to the heights. And that's the hero's ascent. And our civilization, with its commitment to progress and moving to ever brighter future and more and more transcendent realization and wider horizons, that's the whole solar heroic trajectory. But it's forgotten that the sun has to descend. It has to go down. It has to die into the night sky in order to make possible new dawns. And it has to, when it goes into the night sky, it goes into the world of that is ruled by the moon, which is the matrix of all being, out of which all suns, all stars emerge, are born. The night is pregnant with the day, and the day must die into the night, in the same way that the moon and its connection with the great mother goddess is defined by birth, in the same way that the sun, the solar principle of the hero archetype, is ultimately defined by death, because that's what's really truly heroic, is a person who's willing to give his or her life for the whole, for the birth of the new, for the larger good. And we seem to be at that moment where the solar heroic journey is ready to descend. It's going down. It's down. The sun is setting. There's a great conjunctio oppositorum happening between the solar and the lunar principles, out of which a new dawn can emerge. And I believe that the archetypal astrological perspective, the evidence, that revelation of it, is in some sense a very powerful vessel of the night sky, of that which is ruled by the moon, that which is the polytheistic psyche, the feminine dimension of the divine. All these things are coming into the collective psyche very powerfully now, the Gaia principle, the recognition of our connection to the rest of the, not only the human community, but the earth community and the cosmos itself. And so I believe in some sense we are at that moment where a great transfiguration is taking place. And I believe that of all things, this most despised of perspectives, this most ludicrous superstition, the stone that the builders rejected, may in fact hold a great key to our future. I'd like to thank you.